Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Dragon Con.
Saturday, yay.
Thank you for missing the parade. It's kind of boring. You know, never mind. We won't go into the parade.
It's hot outside. You don't
it's hot. It's, yeah. Okay, we're here to discuss.
What are we here to discuss?
Kickstarter.
Wait. Don't, legal issues of kickstarting and crowdfunding. Yep, see, that's why we have these little things. All right, my name's Peter Friedman. I'm a CPA. I do a lot of tax support litigation, which means if you need me, it means that some government agency is looking at you. And I'm here to discuss, I'll be here to help and discuss any tax issues in regards to kickstarting and crowdfunding.
My name is Roger Lang. I'm a patent attorney. That's where I specialize. I do some trademark work, but mainly patent protection. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Hopefully you can hear. My name is Roger Lang. I'm a patent attorney, and I specialize with patents and trademarks. In terms of like with crowdfunding, things like that, I see that when people come to me before they want to launch their campaigns to see what kind of protections they might need. That's about it.
Ryan. Hi, my name is Ryan Green. I'm the practical end of this. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm a computer game developer. I ran with a company called Storybricks, ran a very unsuccessful Kickstarter campaign, unfortunately. But I did write a book on business and legal issues, so I am kind of paid attention to a lot of the issues around crowdfunding. I've helped kind of some other smaller indie people do, you know, small Kickstarter campaigns.
Good morning. My name is Darshan Kendrick. I'm a private equity attorney. So what I do is help businesses when they want to raise capital in exchange for equity in their businesses through investors or venture capital funds. So I help them with that whole legal process.
So I think, I mean, we're all going to probably do about a 4 or 5 minute spiel about what we think may be important or relevant to you, and then we're going to basically take questions. Because I think your questions probably are going to open up a lot more areas and probably are questions that everybody has.
You go first.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I am, like I said, a private equity attorney. So one of the topics is on crowdfunding. So there are several ways that businesses can raise capital. One way is through rewards-based crowdfunding, which is the Kickstarter and the GoGo's that you've talked about. But if you want to solicit investors in exchange for a portion of your company, we call it the equity crowdfunding, then that's where I come in. In 2012, the Congress passed a Jobs Act that you might have heard about, that it was supposed to create more opportunities for entrepreneurs to raise capital. The Securities and Exchange Commission hasn't finalized the rules, but after they finish finalizing the rules, hopefully by the end of the year, it will open up a whole new set of regulations to make it easier for businesses to raise up to $1 million in capital funding. So that's one of the things that I do. What you can do right now that is very interesting is under Georgia, we actually have what's called an Invest Georgia exemption. So we actually have an exemption to the securities law, and you actually can start doing crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding right now. Now, there are some restrictions on that, and I don't want to go too deeply into it because we'll be here for half the day. But get a card from me, and I can email you my slideshare presentation on that. But if you're looking to raise $1 million, under $1 million, in Georgia, there's a way for you to do that right now in Georgia, and you won't have to wait on the federal government to finalize their rules. If you want to raise over $1 million, then there's a number of rules that you can qualify under if you want to raise private equity. But securities law is an interesting area of law. I love it. It's the only type of law that I do. But it is very complex, and you need the gentleman down here at the end of the table to make sure that you stay out of tax trouble. But also, if you have intellectual property, you're definitely going to need an intellectual property attorney to make sure that your rights are being protected while you're doing that fundraising campaign. But I am the go-to lawyer if you want to make sure that you raise capital the right way and actually keep it and don't end up in jail. So that's my plug.
So a lot of the stuff I've been kind of looking at recently has been, like I said, kind of more on the practical end. You know, as a game developer who's, you know, like I said, helped people do crowdfunding and, you know, done a crowdfunding campaign myself, is, you know, what happens, you know, during and after the campaign. Like, one of the particularly interesting issues is refunds. Say you do a Kickstarter campaign, say it's successful, and then later you have to do, you know, people ask for a refund. What's your obligations? And, you know, this is like really kind of murky area. You know, the Kickstarter, you know, the Kickstarter, I think official policy, last I checked, was like, you know, you don't have to give refunds. But, again, you know, some people say, well, you know, there's a moral obligation. You know, you should be, you know, people want money back. I'm working at a company right now that did a Kickstarter campaign. And our policy is, the company's policy is, you know, you ask for your refund, we'll give it to you. We want happy customers rather than, you know, just keeping your money. But I think that's kind of, you know, as we start getting more and more crowdfunding campaigns, I think that we're going to start looking at a lot more interesting issues like that, like refunds. What happens, you know, what happens if you don't deliver, you know, exactly what the person expects? You know, what happens if, you know, especially game development, you know, one of the really interesting things about crowdfunding game development is that a lot of times, you know, how we make the sausage is hidden from people. You know, when you have the traditional publisher funded project, you know, sometimes what you pitch to the publisher ends up being very different at the end. So what happens when you, you know, instead of going to the publisher, you go to crowdfunding, you say, we're going to do X, but you get halfway through it, you know, realize, well, this game really isn't very fun. We need to kind of change it to do something else. You know, publisher, you know, obviously will basically, you know, put you through the rigor, make sure you're not just wasting money. But in a crowdfund campaign, you know, this could be something where people are like, no, I signed up for an action RPG, and now you're telling me that you're going to deliver a first-person shooter. This is not acceptable. And so, you know, what happens in those cases? I think that's going to be a really interesting area that, you know, we're only just starting to begin to touch.
Okay. For me, like, one of the problems that people have is that, especially if you have something that is maybe software-driven or something that is a physical device, maybe you created, you know, a better fly swatter or something like that, and a lot of people don't realize that in the United States, you're giving a little bit of flexibility in terms of when you have to file your patent applications if you want to pursue a patent protection. And some countries, you are given no flexibility at all. They have what's called an absolute novelty requirement, meaning you need to file your applications before you make any kind of public disclosures. The United States will give you a year, but there's also different ways that people trip up and that they create what's called an on-sale bar. Most people think, well, I didn't try to sell them anything by using Kickstarter. That's a really hard argument to make when you say, if you give me money, I'll give you one of these widgets that I make. It's hard to argue that that's not a sale. I don't want to make that argument for you because I don't think it'll win. So in that sense, there are some areas where people, they sort of mess up and give away their inventions and they don't even realize it. And you hate to have to tell that to people when they come to you. And, you know, like, I have questionnaires and things that I go through that I sort of qualify you before I'll even consider helping you. And one of the first questions you ask is, have you made any type of public disclosures? And when you tell people what constitutes a public disclosure, it's almost inevitable. A lot of times they'll tell you, yeah. You know, they, oh, yeah, I showed my brother-in-law. Well, there you go. It doesn't matter. Your brother-in-law is considered part of the public. You know, the... unless there's some kind of a privilege that you have, maybe a spousal privilege or something like that, it's very easy to trip up and give away your invention. So that's one of the areas that I see with the... we refer to them in the patent world as a single inventor, people who work out of their house, kind of things like that, the Kickstarter people, very small companies. So that's some of the things that we see and that we want to try to help people avoid when they do something like a Kickstarter campaign. We don't help you with the marketing and that kind of thing. I'm not a marketer. Now, if some marketer tries to steal your invention, or you were unfortunate enough to call one of those late night TV numbers where they say, hey, let us help you patent your invention, they give you a shiny brochure and charge you $6,000. That, and if they try to steal it from you, I'm happy to help you. Actually, I can refer you to some litigators who can help you. I don't do litigation. But so in that, there's a lot of things that people just don't realize when they go to different manufacturers. I have a list of people that I've done business with. I can point you to different manufacturers. A lot of people don't know how to build their product. A lot of people have an idea for a product, but they don't know how to draw it out, how to sketch it out so that they can create a plan or some type of a blueprint to build it. As a patent attorney, you have to have a background in engineering or science. Mine's mechanical engineering. I went to Georgia Tech, so I know a lot about that kind of thing. I can help you figure out that sort of stuff. I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to engineer your product and figure out, okay, you need to use this spring because it has the right Young's modulus or something like that. I'm not going to do that for you. I don't do that. But I can point you to the people that do that. To me, a truly enlightened professional, I sort of follow the advice of Thomas Stanley, who, if you don't know, he wrote The Millionaire Mind and The Millionaire Next Door. Truly enlightened professional doesn't necessarily know everything, but he knows who to refer you to. I can point you to manufacturers. I can point you to people that can help you. Maybe you want to go the private equity. Maybe that's a better way for you to do it. You don't know enough about business. You want to team up with people who actually do know about business. Point you to someone who knows those people, and they can help you out. So that's one of the things that I do, and I see a lot of it, and it's a lot of fun.
Okay, the quiet one.
Always worry about the quiet ones.
You always worry about the quiet ones. Pretty much one of the things, first of all, the $1 million exemption that's in Georgia for under $1 million, there's an exception from the SEC. A lot of states have it. So if you're not from Georgia, you don't have to move to Georgia to qualify for that exemption. If you would like to move to Georgia, I would say fine, but you know, probably your state also has it. One of the biggest issues that we see is Kickstarter programs or crowdfunding programs that have been successful but have taken a position that the money raised is not taxable income. If you elect, because when you start your entity, you elect your accounting method. I'm putting everybody to sleep now. And there's two methods in reality. There's cash and accrual. If you choose cash and you're in a Kickstarter program, the moment you get that money, that is taxable income to you, period. And if you're selling it and you're getting, and you're selling to the retail public, who's usually, it's, you know, mom and pop investing, you have to, and it's a tangible item, you have to, we'll ignore software because then I'll really put you all asleep. You have a sales tax problem because there's sales tax in most states, not all states, but most states, and if you sell a tangible product, you're supposed to collect it. There is something you can say, well, they're out of state, so therefore I don't have to collect it. And then more and more states are electing Georgia, one of them, the state streamlined tax program, where they don't really care where you are, they care where the other person is. You take cash, collect it, you pay tax on it. Even though, which means that when you went to Kickstarter and when you started to fund it, if you didn't take into consideration that you may lose some of this money, all of a sudden you're underfunded already. This is one of the big issues that we have with Kickstarter or crowdfunding, is that there's taxable income. You cannot defend it from a patent perspective. You can't defend it in front of the IRS or the State Department of Revenue. And if you're selling tangible items, you can't defend it in regards to state sales tax. All right? Nobody's fallen asleep yet. I feel good. All right, I think we're open for questions because I think we'll get a lot more resolved. We do have a rule. I know this is the rule on the questions. Who's got the cute little box? He's got the cute little box. You need the box because it's being recorded, and she wants it. And some of them toss it, so they check your motor skills.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right.
It's a microphone. Yeah, I know.
Something I've always wondered about Kickstarter, when you pledge and you get a perk, right, and the perk is often the final product that you want, right? And some people think that I'm buying this product, but actually you're funding it in hopes of getting this product, and then there's all those Kickstarters and Indiegogos that fail or take forever to deliver the final product, like, you know, Instacube is one I can think of, and I can think of a bunch. So, and people get really angry, but, you know, in a legal sense, what are you owed the final product at any given time, or are you just like kind of donating money in hopes of getting that final product one day?
I've seen articles and cases about this. There, some people have thought that yes, you can sue, and I think I've even seen an article where certain people have failed multiple times, like just epic fails with their campaign. So it looks like they're just collecting money but really not doing anything. In that sense, I've actually seen where some states' attorneys generals are looking into certain groups of people who try to constantly raise funds but don't deliver product. Because they're just really, they just want money. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, yeah, give me some money and I'll give you this thing. Then they get the money and they're like, I ain't got time for that. I got the money. I don't care. But I think Kickstarter's official campaign is that you aren't owed anything. I think their language on their lawyers are good. Kickstarter's got money. Their language in their agreement that says you can or cannot sue them is pretty good. So you're probably not going to get anything from Kickstarter. And hopefully Kickstarter or any of the campaigns, I don't mean to, any of the sites, I don't mean to pick on Kickstarter, but any of the sites are actually noticing that, hey, this particular group of people, they constantly fail. Maybe we don't want to let them keep having campaigns. I would hope that would happen. I don't know if they have a procedure for that or not, but hopefully that would happen. But yeah, as far as I know, you're not entitled to anything.
Yeah, games have had some kind of notable failures in that regard. And you know, there's one I backed, a tabletop RPG that was supposed to deliver a physical book. And it kind of came out later that the guy that was doing it basically had run, I think, like a couple other unsuccessful ones. And it looked like, it didn't look like it was malicious. It looked like basically, you know, he raises funds. Oh, okay, that's not quite enough, so I'm going to do another campaign to raise funds to help finish the first book. And then, oh, okay, for some reason, I'm short on the second book, so he did a third campaign. So I don't think Kickstarter really has anything, because this is specifically your Kickstarter. I mean, that might be, again, like I said, there's a lot of really interesting issues on a practical side, and this might be one of them, is that, you know, maybe eventually there might be some certification process, like, you know, hey, if you failed a Kickstarter campaign within the last, you know, year or two or something like that, you know, of course there's going to be ways around that. You know, people could, you know, organize, you know, form a business entity and do it through the business entity instead of as an individual or whatnot. So, I mean, it's really tough, and, you know, it's, you know, the practical advice, you know, as somebody who supports it, is like, you know, do your homework. You know, don't, I think a lot of people, you know, especially for games, kind of treat it as a pre-order campaign. Like, oh, of course this game's going to be made. Here's my money. You know, I'll get my game sometime down the road. But really what you need to do is you need to look at, you know, who's doing it, what's the track record, you know, what's the, you know, and really look at the likelihood. And again, this is, like I said, kind of an introduction, is that, you know, traditionally we've had publishers that do this. Publishers that look at a company, you know, I go to a publisher with a proposal and they're like, okay, how likely is it this guy's going to be able to do it? And, you know, when you go to crowdfunding, you know, basically that responsibility, you know, shifts toward the end user. And, you know, the end user doesn't necessarily have the expertise to know, okay, can this person deliver or not?
In regards to that, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Like, let's say, like, Shenmue 3, right? Mm-hmm. Where we know that whatever money the general public raises is not enough to make an actual game. And they're going to be backed by bigger companies anyway and investors. So isn't, like, having a Kickstarter, like, what is the point of that? You know, they're going to make it anyway without our money or not. So why have this whole like fake crowdfunding thing where it seems duplicitous? It seems like I don't know what the goal is.
So I mean, quite simply, the goal is basically to show interest. You know, when you go to a publisher and you say, hey, I need X million dollars to complete this game, they're like, okay, that's great, what are the sales going to be like? If you can go to them and say, hey, look, you know, I don't know how many people, you know, support that campaign, but say, you know, like, hey, I had 30,000 people back my campaign. And that's probably, you know, I can, you know, show some, you know, show something and say, okay, maybe that's 10% of the entire, you know, market for, you know, in this area. And then, you know, we look at overseas, you know, essentially you can use that Kickstarter data as essentially market research to show to the publisher and say, hey, look, you know, this is what, you know, I'm going to be able to get this much return out of it. And that can be a better negotiation tactic. I mean, and
it's proof of concept, don't you think?
Yeah, it's really proof of concept.
They're coming saying,
yeah,
right,
Kickstarter, somebody wants this game. Usually a game distributor is going to say, how do we know?
Right?
And basically you slip and say, look, I got 30,000 people on Kickstarter.
Right.
I got proof of concept. Right. I just beat the biggest hurdle for a software distributor.
And
this game will sell.
And if you get money from, you know, the end users, that's less money you have to take from the publisher, so you can basically negotiate better terms with the publisher. I mean, in some ways, you can kind of see it as being a little dishonest to the end users because, you know, again, yeah, they're gonna get the bulk of their money probably from the publisher. On the flip side, is that, you know, the developer can also argue that, look, we took money from these people. If the publisher comes and said, yeah, your action RPG is terrible, we want you to make a first person shooter, they can potentially say, no, look, you know, we promised these people an action RPG, and, you know, we need to basically deliver on that. So, you know, it can also potentially give the developers a little more control because they've already, you know, establish to people what they're going to be selling.
And just a final comment. You know, one of the things that you have to really be careful with Kickstarter and Indiegogo when it relates to equity crowdfunding, again, that's what I'm talking about, not rewards-based crowdfunding, which Kickstarter and Indiegogo, but when you go out to solicit investors, private equity investors. So the SEC is currently looking at finalizing the crowdfunding rules that I mentioned in the introduction. And one of the rules that they are looking for is taking people who do Kickstarter and Indiegogo campaigns and counting it towards what you would qualify for a private placement exemption. So, for example, if you wanted to raise under a Regulation D private placement exemption and $5 million is the cap, if you've already raised $1 million through a Kickstarter or Indiegogo, even though it's rewards-based crowdfunding, they're going to say, well, you can that $1 million you already raised counts towards your $5 million, so you can only actually raise $4 million. So for people who are doing those campaigns, the rules again are not finalized, but that's another legal issue that you're going to need to worry about, even if you're doing rewards-based crowdfunding.
And I'm going to say one thing, just because I talk a lot, is that if you do it for a perk and they don't deliver, there is enough case law that says, and you're never going to get it, you can theoretically deduct this as a casualty loss. If you do it from an equity investment, all right, then you get into some interesting rules, and it is a capital loss if it doesn't get funded or they close up. The difference being is a capital loss up to $3,000 goes directly against your wages, so therefore it's really nice, it reduces directly your tax bill. A casualty loss goes below along with your state income tax, your real estate taxes, and it can get limited. So if you're going to look at Kickstarter from a tax perspective with a concept it's going to fail, you'd rather go into the equity section. Well, you know, a couple of Jack Daniels, oh, this looks like a great idea. You know, you just sit there and say, well, let's go for equity. And there's even more refined rules about it. But just realize there is, you're not totally, I can't really sue the person because you're never probably going to get any money. They're probably judgment-proof. So unless you want to basically keep funding attorneys, which some people have this need.
We don't mind.
Right. Yeah. There are addicted people that say, oh, my God, I have to pay an attorney for something. Let me do it now.
Like, where are they?
You know.
Here's my card.
See? They're jumping on this. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
On the subject of DMCAs, malicious DMCAs, if you have a crowdfunding campaign torpedoed by a malicious DMCA, you know, somebody basically trolling your campaign, it shuts the campaign down, money's lost. What are your recourses as a creator to stop that, go after that? Are they liable for any of the money you may have lost if you're trending towards success and that affects your success at the Kickstarter? Is there anything as an operator of a Kickstarter that you would be able to do following that, especially in a clear case of maliciousness?
With DMC, you mean the Digital Millennium Copyright Act?
Yeah, where they have to take it down no matter what. Anybody can shut down.
Well, you can say, hey, I actually own that copyright, send off almost a form letter, and then a lot of ISPs, they'll pull stuff down because they don't want to get sued. Because there's a certain safe haven provision. I'm not a copyright expert. There's somebody in the next panel that does that. I'm not sure what there are in terms of any kind of recourses you have against that. I've never seen it happen. I just don't know.
I know, like, I was reading through, and I know they have, like, you know, a false DMCA is, there's like criminal things, but they don't really tell you how to go about prosecuting that on the back end. That like
copyright,
once it happens.
Like, copyright's a weird area of intellectual property law because it's the only one I'm aware of that you can actually go to jail for. If you for violating copyright, you've all seen the thing in front of movies, you know, 5 years, $250,000. Patent law, I mean, customs will help stop stuff from coming into the country, like they'll stop it on the ship and not let them, you know, take it off the container ships. But if you got the money to fight that, to have that happen and go through the different courts that you're going to need to have that happen, that's, you're probably not raising money through Kickstarter if you have that kind of money. But in terms of the copyright thing, I'll be honest with you, I just don't know. Like I say, come to the next panel. I know there's a copyright expert in that one.
So once again, I'm not a lawyer. This isn't legal advice. But one of the things you can do, you know, there's actually a very specific procedure for DMCA complaints. Mm-hmm. And as an owner, as somebody targeted by a DMCA complaint, you should have recourse where you can basically contact Kickstarter and say, no, this is a false complaint. And they should have a system for recourse where
they'll tell you they're not lawyers. They have to run the 10 days. If they don't sue you,
right,
they'll put it back up for you. I got the generic response.
Right. Yeah. So that's basically your best recourse unless you have that addiction where you want to pay lawyers to get things going. Basically that's probably your best bet. You know, try to, you know, hopefully, you know, whatever channels you were using, I mean, and on a practical level, I mean, use this as a PR event. Say, hey, look, somebody, you know, my campaign was so successful, somebody felt like they had to target it. You know, turn that into a PR story, you know, work through that 10 days that you're basically kind of in limbo. You know, use whatever, you know, resources you already talked to. Maybe even thought, like I said, computer game, you know, I'm in computer games. Go to the computer game site, say, hey, you know, because like Minecraft was pretty noticeable, like, you know, Minecraft got their account frozen by PayPal. That was a huge PR coup for them, you know, where, you know, Notch basically, you know, everybody's like, Minecraft, what's that? Oh, shit, you know, this is really cool. And then they kind of, you know, really took off after that. You know, if you can kind of, you know, on a practical level, spin that, you know, like, hey, somebody sent me this false complaint and took me down, but we're going to come back and we're fighting this. And, you know, and basically then, you know, then when you get your Kickstarter campaign back in action, hopefully you can kind of pick up the momentum again if you did have that kind of positive momentum. And you might even have more people because, hey, you got covered in more press areas.
Yes, I was wondering, based on the level that you've set for crowdfunding, is it better to, you know, based on certain levels, is it better to go with the cash accounting or with the accrual accounting? And if you go with the cash accounting, is there any guidelines as to, based on your level, how much you really want to set aside for the potential tax impact that you might incur?
If it depends on the product you're making. If you're a game company, you're going accrual. You're never going to go with cash.
Okay.
That also stops the issue of, hi, I'm doing a kickstarting campaign, I'm getting money for a future game, let's call it that. Let's, you know, or even, we won't deal with the equity because then it gets really dicey. Mm-hmm. No offense, man.
Yeah, no, it is.
No. So the issue would be I would always do accrual.
Okay.
If your product is basically, hi, I'm starting a restaurant and my perk is that you get this free coupon, right? You know, if you're a restaurant, I always say go cash. Right. So it really relies upon what you're really going to do.
Okay.
All right? There is no limit. I mean, you know, and the other thing is that no matter what method you choose in the beginning, there is an ability that you can petition the IRS commissioner to change your accounting method. So if you start with cash and all of a sudden, after the Kickstarter starts, and if you're a company and you're in Georgia, you better put away 30% for taxes because that's what it's going to be, and hopefully the sales tax people don't come in on you. But you can always petition the commissioner and say, "I chose cash. I made a mistake. Here's the last 3 years of what I did. Here's what it would have been if I had chosen accrual. I want to go back. I want to go to accrual." And usually, if the form is done right, pretty much the government rubber stamps it. You know, the biggest difference between, you know, lawyers and accountants is they have forms on their computer that they hit a button and print out. We have forms made by the government, and we just fill them out.
But now, with the, in terms of what you were talking about with withholdings, would you say that it matters when you have your campaign? I mean, if your campaign ends in around, say, November, which probably not a good time because everybody's going to be spending their money on Christmas instead of Kickstarters, but you won't have any time to incur any expenses, will you, between the end of the tax year?
Which is why, from a cash perspective,
okay,
that's all income.
Okay.
And you have no expenses. So therefore, you basically have this great income number and no expenses.
That they're going to tax the heck out of at that point.
Well, they'll take 30%.
Right.
You know, that's what you should do. If it's an equity issue, then pretty much you're sitting there saying, excuse me, this is really a purchase of stock. The problem with that is you fall directly into the rules of the DREG and the $1 million exemption and the potential SEC rules of you're going out and saying that you're selling people stock. Now you want to go for a second round because usually Kickstarter is really what it is. It's a kickstart, and then you're going to need a second round of funding, mm-hmm. right? You're pretty much sitting, you know, you can't sit there and say, well, now I want to go out and get $5 million if I raised $1 million on Kickstarter, because she's going to look at you and say, you said it was equity. You know, yes, said it was equity. So you didn't have to pay the tax bill, but now you're not going to raise another $5 million because that would be $6 million, and therefore you're way right. off of that.
Okay.
It's really interrelated. Everything kind of is interrelated in the beginning, as it always is.
Thank you.
He moves slow. I should have gotten more coffee.
Hi. We've put together what we think is, obviously everybody thinks that their product is terrific, a program to help children deal with social issues. You know, and we're presenting it, you know, to a variety of school districts in their area. And obviously schools in the districts don't have a lot of money to fund. What I'd like to know is that would we be better off, you know, trying to fund one district at a time, you know, and have smaller campaigns, or do it on a regional basis? Like, do you have any idea what our success, you know, like possibilities are, you know, like at different levels? Eventually, we'd like to go statewide, you know, obviously, but you have to start somewhere, you know, so we're starting with our local schools. No clue.
Well, as a business person dealing with businesses, I would always say if you want to go statewide, plan to go statewide and do a Kickstarter campaign for a small district, because right now you haven't proven proof of concept. Mm-hmm. You have no proof of concept. I'm not saying your idea isn't good.
Sure.
Okay. But there's no proof of concept. If you basically go statewide and you prove a small district, if you could get a small district to say, oh, don't worry, I'm going to do this for you. But then, I got to tell you, you're not giving a perk. You're basically giving some of the equity away. And you're on that side of the street. Well, notice how you like this has became a street.
Yeah. Part of our program is that we have a concert pianist who teaches children, you know, like using music, you know, like, and it has worked very effectively with kids who can't learn, you know, like otherwise. So what we're going to do is deliver a, CD with his music on it. You know, like, I don't know if that's enough, you know, a reward for people.
Well, but understand, you give them a CD, you have a sales tax issue, you have income already given to your company because you're selling a CD. She's probably donating the CD for free,
right.
So therefore you have no cost basis on that CD. So if you're saying, I'm not doing equity, notice I do equity and I look down that side, and I'm selling a CD because that's in reality what you're doing. You have sales tax on the CD because you're probably selling it to the public, and you have income on the sale of the CD. You'll have a tax bill on the sale of the CD, and probably, I would assume, the concert pianist who is supporting your organization is donating those CDs to you.
Yes.
So you have an income tax bill. You may want to rethink how you're doing it. And also, and be careful, I got caught on one of these there where, we always tell war stories, don't we? Somebody also did it and said, oh, you can have a free concert. And they did it in a state that basically charges an amusement tax. Concerts basically are amusement tax issues. So when the tax man came in, they said, well, you know, you have an income tax problem, and you also have, you didn't pay the amusement tax. And in our state, if you don't file for the license to do an amusement tax, there's a minimum $150,000 penalty. Jeez. And it was like, well, wait a minute, I only raised. They don't care. You got to really talk to somebody. But in regards to your first question, would I go statewide? I would go statewide versus district. And I would then basically use this, the district that you could find as a proof of concept.
Thank you. For the exit or the other information, too. Appreciate it.
I talk a lot.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm considering using Patreon to fund an upcoming ongoing project. And I was just wondering if anybody had any advice or insights, legal, tax, or otherwise, specifically regarding Patreon and the way they do crowdfunding.
Anybody dealt with Patreon?
I mean, I've backed some people on Patreon. Okay. I'm a big Nerd Raid supporter. God does amazing science. I mean, in that sense, again, maybe it goes back to what is it you're producing? I mean, if you're doing like the Saturday morning breakfast cereal cartoon, those things are hilarious. You know, that guy, he maybe has some copyright things that he needs to worry about, but I don't know, what are you providing through that? Is there a sales tax thing? I mean, that's something you sit down with your accountant with and figure that out.
In my case, it's just gonna be informational website and videos and possibly a podcast to support it. So I didn't know if there really were any kind of real issues around any of
those. I'm pretty sure the IRS is gonna consider it income.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting money from somebody.
Right.
That's what they're going
to
tell you.
And all I've really thought of so far is to assume that it would be, you know, income based on what kind of business structure I'm using, if any, and the applicable laws. So I didn't know if I needed to consider anything beyond that. So.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously, you know, if you're giving out physical rewards too, you know, as we've said, you know, that might be a sales tax issue because, you know, you're technically exchanging physical items for income. So, you know, definitely kind of pay attention to that. You know, I don't know if you're, you know, it sounds like you're not giving out physical awards, so that might be not.
No plans for that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, basically, you know, from a little I know from it, you know, definitely keep track of it as income, expect to pay income tax on it, you know, the self-employment tax and whatnot. So, you know, that's probably your best bet.
Thanks.
I have a question for our panel, because we're kind of skirting an issue. And I think the question that I have and is this. You go into a Kickstarter campaign and basically all of a sudden the company really takes off. Has there been any consideration that what you thought you were buying all of a sudden became an equity interest in either their IP or in their stock of their company? Because if they don't get a perk, what are they really getting? Mm-hmm. I mean, people are giving money. People are supposed to get money back. Mm-hmm. Nobody's filing a gift tax return on this. We all know that. Yes. And the company, basically, if it's a corporation, has no ability to accept gifts. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you're out there and you're raising money, you know, thinking, this is nice people, you know, and then all of a sudden the company really takes off, have you seen anything or can you opine upon, as best you can, of course, can we take that campaign and make it a high? I bought stock.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the few situations where that is a possibility. I have seen people make the argument that because a product or a service has taken off, that they actually bought into some equity, and that's when you really get into sort of securities law and have to go back and search within each one of the Securities Act to see if there actually was an intention on the part of the person making the purchase to invest as an investor, or were they doing it as a gift? And unfortunately, the SEC is not the clearest federal agency when it comes to things like that, as you can imagine. So it really is on a case-by-case basis. But the important thing to remember is with all the private placement offerings, when you're trying to do equity crowdfunding or doing private placement offerings, there are always going to be restrictions on the amount that you can raise, on who you can raise to, on the time period that you can raise to. So if you're just sort of raising money and you're doing it with a view of doing it only for rewards and not for equity, you could run into a lot of problems. You could go over the dollar amount that the SEC allows you can give. You can sell to the wrong investor and not qualify for a private placement offering. And when you do that, then you go into a whole nother area of securities law where you have to actually register with the SEC. And that can be a headache and time consuming. The SEC has powers to actually recommend to the Department of Justice that you be put in jail. So it's one of those types of agencies. So you just have to be careful if you're the issuing company, what it is that you're doing, that you make clear that it is rewards-based. But is the SEC is really going to look at the intentions of the person that's giving the money, what their intentions, were they investing in to get equity or were they investing in order to get rewards? And that's based on my experience.
I mean, the closest example I can probably think of this from a practical example would probably be Oculus Rift, mm-hmm. where, you know, a lot of people supported that and then they turn around and get sold to Facebook for $1 billion and everybody's like, wait a minute. And, you know, this is a case where, you know, actually giving physical goods was actually kind of a good thing for them because they can say, look, you bought the physical good, you didn't buy into the company. Yeah, sure, we were looking for investors to buy us out, but, you know, you don't get a chunk of that action. You were specifically buying the Oculus Rift kit. And so, you know, people kind of felt a little betrayed and maybe, you know, like mm-hmm. they should get a little piece of the action, but, you know, mm-hmm. the from a legal point of view, it's like, nope, you were buying an item, you got the item, end of story. Mm-hmm.
From an intellectual property perspective, just because you give me some money to help fund getting a patent, that doesn't give you pretty much anything unless there's some kind of a contract that would state otherwise for an assignment. In the United States, patent rights vest in the inventor to begin with, and then they're assigned to like a company or something like that. So unless there's some kind of a legal contract, just because you give me money, that doesn't mean you own any part of my patent. As far as I know, there's no case law on that. Now, if you hire someone to help you build the thing, you can hire someone to help you build it, or that maybe they're just a nice person. You have a friend who's a machinist or something like that, and they can build it. And just because they built it for you, that does not make them an inventor. There is case law out there that says I can hire an artisan to build the thing because I don't know how or I don't have the tools, but that doesn't make them an inventor. They're simply the builder. So you can... But again, if you're doing it the right way, you already got your agreements in place long before that person started working or before you told them about it. There's no question that they don't own anything. So spend a little bit of money up front and save a lot of money down the road.
Who has the box? God, that sounds so wrong.
Hey, hello. Good morning. I have a middle of the road question.
Oh, good.
So we talked about video games and we talked about like a physical product getting in someone's hands. And you said that, like, if you're basically video game, you want to do accrual. If you're doing physical objects, you want to do sales tax, you want to do cash. What happens about pen and paper RPGs, especially in the modern era, where you can give it out digitally, like a video game, like a piece of software, and a lot of the time you have to ship them something physically? Mm-hmm. Which, where do you go, accrual or cash?
RPG physical games, yeah. I kind of lump in with... software game. When I say game, it's not just software, it's also the physical RPG. And the reason why I say accrual is even in a Kickstarter operation, unless that game is made and you're ready to ship it tomorrow, and all you're doing is a Kickstarter to prove concept so you can go to a distributor, you have a hell of a lot of costs to develop on that product. All right? Including packaging if you're going to ship it, including design. You're going to have attorneys you're going to be going to. All these things are expenses that, under your accrual basis, you can deduct. And you're picking up all this income, hopefully, from Kickstarter that you don't have to declare as income. You're just basically treating it as you're treating it as non-recognized revenue because it's not recognized till you perform, which is ship the product. So from that perspective, That's why when I said game, it's accrual.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
That was more like the end. It wasn't more of the middle of the road. I thought you two guys were going to have it. You
know. Good morning. I'm the attorney friend to several groups of people attempting to start or considering Kickstarters.
Hi.
Right.
I'll take you out. Here's a cup of coffee. And by the way, I have 500
right.
questions
yeah.
for a cup of coffee. Not that I don't want to pay you, but you're a friend.
Yeah.
You're it's one
like,
of those.
It feels like you hear those musicians who talk about, but you love making music. Why won't you play my wedding for free?
Hey.
And like,
yeah.
When I was growing up, my dad told me, don't ever give away your services. He would not even do work for family for free. The only person I do work for free are my mom and my dad. Everybody else pays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
you
I
value
actually,
your service. Nobody else will.
Yeah. That I agree with that. And even dad's getting to the close to the point where he might start getting charged. Yeah, he's pushing
that
some of this.
Just does not make
yeah,
it.
My mom, my mom has got more value out of my law school education than me, I think. I
mean, they paid for it, so you know.
Yeah, I mean,
future cost of.
They taught me how to use a toilet when I was a kid, okay?
Yeah. They're good. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, this is being recorded. That was an overshoot.
Okay, they just,
that's all I'm going to say. Yes, go ahead.
And I suppose it's just actually, now it's just intellectual curiosity. They're debating whether being individuals doing a Kickstarter campaign together versus any number of the corporations that you can become, or businesses that you can become as corporations, LLM, LLP, or LLPs. And I'm like, I would think that the most protection, if this goes horribly, horribly wrong, or really well, would be an S corporation rather than a group of individuals aligned in the same general direction on the same project.
When I was in law school, the guy that he was my contracts professor, he's also one of the leading experts on LLCs, corporations, and partnerships, a guy named Daniel Kleinberger. He's a brilliant individual. He said that the only reason that people end up in partnerships or general partnerships is bad legal advice or by accident.
Mm-hmm.
So a group of people simply working together, not realizing it, that can get you in trouble real fast, because
really
next thing you know, you're liable for that dude's mistakes. Or I will never advise someone to just, let's just hang out and work together. No.
And I want to make something very clear. Even though I got, let's say all four of us said, oh, let's work on a project together, we've in essence created a general partnership under the IRS code. Even though we're saying, oh no, we're all individual. Mm-hmm. No. We created a general partnership, and when you want to go raise money from a third party, you do not do it under a general partnership.
No.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, most states now recognize LLCs, limited liability companies, limited liability partnerships. I would not do a sub S just because there's still quite a lot of restrictions on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, if you say, well, one day I'm going to be so big, I got to become a corporation, I'm going to go on the SEC stock exchange, well, you know what, I can take an LLC and I can basically convert it to a regular corporation that can get traded.
And you can do single member LLCs in Georgia, which you can't do that all, you know, throughout the United States. So even if somebody is just one person, they can protect themselves by becoming a single member LLC. And S corps do limit the number of investors that you can have. So you need to take that into account as well.
And the reason why I don't like S corporations is pretty much a lot of states have started to rescind the acceptance of it.
Yeah.
So therefore, you're federally filing an S-Corp and thinking you're God's gift to the world, I'll just pass through all the taxes and the income and the expenses to me. And then the state comes back and says, excuse me, we don't accept S-Corps. So you're a corporation now, you're going to pay it in the corporation, and you're going to take, and we're going to consider all the money you took out as compensation to you, so you get your double taxation.
Mm-hmm. And I think Georgia actually taxes corporations on their wealth. I think there's an actual, there's a small wealth tax on the, like whatever your corporation is valued at the end of the year, I think you have to pay taxes on that.
It's a greater up.
Yeah, so I mean, you could end up, the S-Corp, you know, it sounds great on paper, but it can get you in trouble real quick if you're not careful.
Yeah, and just from a, you know, as a creator myself, yeah, limited liability is awesome. You know, and having a business structure is so much better than not having a business structure if you're going to work with other people.
I will just echo from a practical point of view exactly what they've said here. Like, you know, if you're going to work with someone, even if it's your best friend from childhood, you know, form a company, get founders agreements, do the whole nine yards.
And when you have those agreements, I know a lot of people who make a very good living off people who used to be friends.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
When money gets involved, friendship can sort of, no, you suck. And no, I mean, just that whole thing. I mean, it can really go sideways real fast on you. And if you have all the necessary business agreements in place ahead of time, it's very clear what's expected of everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That happened exactly to me, where, you know, it's somebody I thought was a good friend of mine, started a company, he decided he wanted out. You know, I'm like, yeah, I don't think it would have been a particularly messy split, but it's like, here's the agreement. You know, we execute on this exactly what we said. And, you know, that you're out of the company, you have no claim against us. You know,
and a good agreement will have exit clauses for everybody. Mm-hmm. It'll say, this is how you're going to leave. This is what you might be entitled to when you leave.
Because emotion's going to run high at that point. You're not going to be in the hey, let's sit down and discuss it. No, you're going to be like, fuck you.
Yeah.
And you're going to want some agreement, you know, so where somebody else can point to and say, okay, this is how we're going to execute this list of exactly what it says in this document. And we know exactly what it's going to look like at the end of that.
And I call them business prenups, because they really they really can get messy. And you know, when you're walking down the aisle with that person, everything's good until you know the honeymoon is over. And they really are business prenups that really do save heartache and time and money.
Absolutely.
And the only thing I can tell you, and I'm enforcing this, is that when you're starting up, nobody's thinking it's not going to succeed.
Right.
Everybody is so easy going, oh, if I leave or you leave, you know, we'll work it out. You know, we'll put it on paper. You get this and that. Why? Because there's no pie to cut up, because it doesn't exist. But as soon as a piece of pie shows up, all of us are,
I will stab you.
What do you mean? I am the creator. You are just a measly person. I'll take 95%. You can keep the 5%. And you're sitting there going, wait a minute. We have this prenup here. You know? He said, well, you know, I'll challenge that in court. And say, yeah, good luck. Yeah. You know? Yeah. But go ahead. And by the way, try not to give your services away for free, because you may be looking at a litigation if you got two people that basically hate each other. They're going to say, we replied on her. Yeah. We bought her a cup of coffee, so therefore we paid for her services.
Mm-hmm. Make sure your malpractice is in order.
Yeah, really big. Double it.
Oh, yeah. I'm an attorney who unlicenses other attorneys. So that's what I do, is I work in licensing. So if you have a license, I've probably taken it away. So I know that. So I don't even, like, people come to me in this group and they're like,
you,
we
you
have
still
a question.
Have friends?
And I'm like, no, you don't. Sit down. Be quiet.
You've
no
I like her.
And you still have friends.
I feel like, and she has friends.
I have
no friends.
I don't have a lot of attorney friends.
We have musicians that want to give away. Okay.
Yeah, let me tell you, I hang out with a bad crowd. I know too many attorneys. So.
You can't know too many attorneys. I can't tell you the number of times I've been brought up in someone else's conversation. I know an attorney is like, no, you don't. You don't know it. No, I'm not your attorney. I'm your attorney when you pay and have a contract.
Wasn't that a great line of the Goodbye Girl? I know this attorney. Oh, yeah, I know the play from that.
Oh, my yes. My mom loves that. My son's an attorney. Yeah. Telling people that, mom?
My mom doesn't say that. You know, it's like, hi, my son's a doctor. Oh, that's my brother. Me. God knows what I am. Yes.
All right, so I know this one's probably going to be a little bit of a thorny issue, and I completely understand if this one gets kicked to the curb.
Okay.
But I'm building I'm with a group of people who's building a project. The company who owns the intellectual property of that piece knows we exist. They've given us a tentative ability to build the item, as long as we don't raise funds for it. Which, okay, fine, makes things a little harder. Whatever. However, we've come across a couple of issues where we've wanted to go places as a group, not to raise funds for the project, just to get us to places. What can we do to raise funds for us? Because as example, we were offered to go to go somewhere. They were going to pay for the transport costs on the item, but we had to get ourselves there. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to do a Kickstarter to say, hey, look, you're paying for us as a group to go to this place and to get, you know, go there, get back, hotel rooms, food, and all that stuff. No, none of the absolute zero of this money was going to the project.
Well, I'll go ahead and tell you, first of all, I should have said this when I started. I'm not giving anyone in this room specific legal advice. I'm
very clear. Right.
I made that disclaimer already.
That's fair enough.
I don't have a disclaimer.
I don't know all the facts of your situation. Right. But right. I mean, if these people own the IP, you're trying to do this other thing, they see you raising money. I mean, you could easily run afoul. You need to get you some good agreements in place that says you can do this, you can't do that. That clearly defines what is considered raising money for you as a group and not for the project. I mean, it sounds like you're skating on a very thin line and you could easily fall off and hurt yourself.
Right. Well, we didn't go through with it because...
Well, no, I mean, it doesn't matter. Just continuing with this venture, the way that you're doing it, it sounds like you almost have handshake agreements and they're worth about as long as the handshake lasts. I mean, it sounds like you're skating in some very dangerous water, swimming in very dangerous waters.
And it really doesn't matter really what the legal issue is. It's really going to come down to what does the IP holder think of it.
Yeah, and if they got more money than you, they're going to win in court.
Right.
Exactly. Well, they're obviously going to win
and
in court.
If they think you've run afoul of the rules, then you've run afoul of the rules. Unless you're independently wealthy and you feel like you have that addiction where you want to pay lawyers. But the reality of it is talk to them. I mean, if you've got a contact there, talk to them. Ask them. Say, hey, look, we want to do this. Get some kind of written approval for, if they say sure. You can raise funds to travel. Get some kind of written approval, email, whatever. And the best next step is basically get a document laying out specifically what you can and cannot do.
And I just want to say that if you go back to the person that's holding the IP, I personally would advise you to have an attorney do it and not you, because I don't know how many times I've had a taxpayer go in front of a government agency because they don't want to hire a professional because they know better, and the crap that we have to unwind because they know better is like five times as much as if they had come and hired a professional in the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
Hi, so my question, my friend and I, we're working on the same pen and paper role-playing game, and we're sort of going between our two options of, for physical books, doing the more traditional, order a bunch of books printed and then ship them out to the customers or the backers, but then also doing a print on demand thing, which I'm more in favor of because I think that they might have a structure to handle sales tax for their procedure as opposed to us going through the sales tax of just shipping out books ourselves. Do any of you have any thoughts on that distinction?
I don't even know what you just said.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. And I looked at him because he was the major author of a book I contributed to.
Yeah.
I think that the issue is who owns the intellectual property of the book.
We do.
Yeah.
So you're going to have the ultimate, if you basically are basically having the book created for you and then you're going to ship it out and you're paying them a flat fee. And then you're going to be collecting income. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have a sales tax issue. They're going to sit there and say, we sent it out to a third-party distributor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have a sales tax issue, but because we're not going retail, I don't have to pay sales tax. You're going retail, you have to pay sales tax.
And I think for the print-on-demand issue, I think that, if you're doing a crowdfunding campaign where you're taking money for the book and then basically just arranging for the print-on-demand to basically handle the shipping and whatnot, you're probably still going to be liable for sales tax because you collect the money. After the crowdfunding campaign, say you just make your book available on a print-on-demand company, they might be able to handle the sales tax at that point because they're collecting the money and then they're passing the money through to you and they can collect sales tax and remit the sales tax and handle that. But I think, again, not a lawyer, not legal advice, and definitely not a tax attorney, so this is not tax advice either, but I think you're probably going to be still on the hook for that if it's, you know, unconfident. Either way, so I think, you know, this becomes a pure business issue. Like, what's going to be the most efficient for you? What's going to be the most cost efficient for you? But keep in mind, you're probably going to have to deal with sales tax issues.
Great, thank you.
Hey, you've kind of touched on this before when you mentioned, like, with the publishing or something, if you just try to put your goal as the amount it'll be published, you'll be underfunded because of taxes and everything. So could y'all just do, like, a ballpark range of the stuff you'll need to consider when you decide how much money you need, besides, like, say if it was publishing a book, besides the just print cost?
Whatever you think it is, double it.
Just double
it? And you're underfunded. I think the first thing, the things that I see as an accountant when people come in and say, oh, I'm going to do a campaign, all right, the first thing I say is, I don't see a line for attorneys. Because I usually say, if you think any accountant's going to do it for this, you have been on serious, serious issues, you know, because people say, oh, well, you're an accountant, you'll do all this for like $250. And I'm sitting, I say, you can't even get H&R Block to do this for $250, and much less me, and I'm not taking equity in companies anymore to do the work. So I would double it, but if you don't have it, if you haven't contacted a legal firm, all right, and find out what they're gonna charge you, and if you haven't contacted your accountant to find out what they're gonna charge you, and if you haven't contacted your insurance agent to find out what liability insurance you're gonna need, all right? If those lines aren't on your Kickstarter campaign or your budget, then dramatically you're underfunded.
And that goes back to what I mentioned earlier, like I love reading all the books by Thomas Stanley. Sadly, he passed away earlier this year, but if you come to somebody like me and you ask me these questions, I'm not an accountant, but I can point you to people who can tell you, okay, this is what it's going to cost to manufacture this. You need a set of injection molds. How many people in here know how much a set of injection molds costs? That could be $30,000, and you're asking for $5,000 on Kickstarter because you know that you can buy this little piece for $5. Well, it's very expensive in the upfront to get it set up. So if you have a group of professionals, like he mentioned, they can tell you, they can point you to the people to figure out what it's going to cost. You want to go equity funding, right? She can tell you what that might cost. You know, these are the people who can do these things, and like I said, they're not going to work for free.
And there is one thing about professionals. I'm going to basically caveat. If you go to a professional, and if he sits there and says, you know, you sit there and say, well, can you help me network to do exactly what Roger's saying so that you can point me to, and he's saying, I don't do that, go get another professional.
Yes. He's not a professional.
You know, because his job is to make your life easy. Believe it or not, your job is not to just make sure you can afford a Mercedes-Benz. All right? Go make sure that whoever you hire is willing to help you go a better route.
And I do know only of a few people who are professionals. Some of them with rewards-based crowdfunding will do some type of, you know, commission off the total amount that you raise. I don't do rewards-based crowdfunding. But I know on the equity side that is not allowed. So a lot of people will come to me and say, well, if I want to raise $5 million, can't you just take, you know, 10% of whatever I raise? That violates federal securities law. You get into a whole broker-dealer type of relationships that's specifically prohibited. So if you are trying to do equity-based crowdfunding or do private placement offerings, if a professional tells you, no, I can't do that, they're not lying. It's prohibited under the federal securities law, so they can't take a commission like that.
And if a CPA says it, basically just report it to the state and have him stripped of his license.
One thing I think that, you know, like I said, you know, crowdfunding is still pretty new, but, you know, I think that, you know, probably one of the things that might be really useful here in the future would be like a lot of people, you know, seek out somebody who's done a successful crowdfunding campaign similar to what you do. I mean, it's like, you know, if you start a business, you know, people come to me, it's like, okay, you know, I want to do this. I'm like, well, okay, you're paying salaries, but are you paying payroll taxes? Have you accounted for any benefits you want to pay? You know, have you accounted for any of this other stuff? Because I've started a business before. You know, look for some, if you want to do a crowdfunding campaign, see if you can't find somebody that's done a, you know, successful or even unsuccessful campaign. You know, just somebody, try to reach out to them, try to contact them, say, hey, could you give me a little bit of help? You know, and sometimes it's going to be exactly the same thing. They may, oh, hey, yeah, you need injection molding. I know somebody who could do it at a, you know, at, it does really good quality at a lower price. You know, make contacts. You know, you don't have to do it alone.
Okay.
And thank you. That's about all we got time for, unfortunately. So I'd like to thank our panelists.
Okay. Thank you for skipping up so late. Hopefully, it's education.
Yeah. Hopefully, we're better. Well, we probably weren't.
No.